So we're Matthew 5, verse 13, and I want to start with a little bit of information I found on the internet about what salt does for us. I have not verified all these things, so you medical doctors, let me know if I get it wrong. But according to these following unverified sources, our bodies use salt to regulate fluid intake and manage the pH balance of our body, to regulate the volume of our blood, to balance blood sugar levels, to make calcium and potassium, and make the enzymes that digest food, also make enzymes that attack and break down bad microbes and parasites. Salt also helps us to retain water when we need it, and that we can't live without adequate salt intake. Our lives depend on salt. What about, well, there are different kinds of salt, aren't there? There's table salt, and there's this kind of salt. have you ever made homemade ice cream out of using this kind of salt? You get the churn and fill a bucket with ice, and you put salt in the ice, and the salt lowers the melting point of the ice so that it becomes a liquid, even though it's still at a freezing temperature. And then you churn that. Whether you get, I grew up using the old hand crank churn. Sit on that thing and churn that thing forever, it seemed like, until the ice cream would freeze. But my mom always told me, don't eat the salt. Why is that? Well, this salt is a low grade. It has a lot of impurities in it. It was not purified in order to make sure that it was pure sodium chloride. This stuff has a lot of dirt and stuff in it, who knows what. This was not intended for us to eat. So there's different kinds of salt. Some of it isn't good to eat. Jesus said that we are the salt of the earth. He uses a plural, you, so that's why I have the y'all up on the screen. Are the salt of the earth. Now, if the salt should happen to be made substandard, in what way could it be made into salt? It's good for nothing anymore, except to be thrown outside, to be stepped on by people. Jesus says, we're the salt of the earth. He mentions this concept a number of times throughout his ministry. It's mentioned here in early on in his ministry in the Sermon on the Mount. It's also mentioned later on when he is in Capernaum after his disciples had had a run-in with some other people that were trying to do miracles in Jesus' name but weren't followers of the disciples themselves. Jesus said, have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. Later on in Perea, Jesus was lecturing about the cost of becoming a Christian. And he says, salt is good, but even if the salt has become tasteless, with what should it be seasoned or made salty again? What did he mean? Was Jesus talking about us turning into salt crystals? He's talking about something figurative here. He's talking about people and qualities of people. How is salt used throughout the rest of the Bible? What clues can we get from that? Apart from the geographic uses of the word salt, the Hebrew Bible uses the word salt sea for what we call the Dead Sea. Apart from those geographic things, we see that salt is used for enhancing flavor. Job said, can something tasteless be eaten without salt? Or is there any taste in the white of an egg? I can't eat a boiled egg unless it's got a lot of salt and seasoning on it. Otherwise, it makes me nauseated. There's something to salt that makes things taste good. That is figuratively applied by Jesus, I think, when he told his disciples, have salt in yourselves, be at peace with one another. Enhance the pleasantness of what's going on in these relationships, guys. Don't have fights with people that want to do miracles in my name. Paul also says in Colossians 4:6 that our speech should be seasoned with grace, like the food being seasoned with salt. It just makes things taste better. It helps people relate better if we bring pleasantness to a conversation, just like salt brings pleasantness to food. Salt is also another way that salt is spoken of in the Bible is as a sterilizing agent. We have Sodom and Gomorrah get rained on with brimstone and salt, and Lot's wife is turned into a pillar of salt, which is what that picture in the back is supposed to be representing. We have Gideon, the judge, his son Abimelech, that conquered Shechem and sowed it with salt. Why did he do that? Because he knew that he would ruin the town and people couldn't be able to resettle it if there was so much salt in the soil, because salt would prevent crops from growing in the field. Later on in Jesus' ministry, he says in Luke chapter 14 that salt is good, but if it becomes tasteless, it's useless either for the soil or for, and depending on what your translation is, the manure pile or the compost pile. People use manure to fertilize their fields. But if you put salt in there, then it's going to ruin the ability of that manure to fertilize your field. Salt is a sterilizing agent. It was also mentioned by Ezekiel as apparently a way of sterilizing and cleaning up a baby after birth. There's blood immediately after the newborn comes out. He's covered with a bunch of junk, and they would apparently just rub the baby down with some salt and wrap him up in cloths. It was part of cleaning the baby up. Salt was a cleansing agent. Like maybe the bath salts in the background of that picture, and the soap. Elisha at one point throws salt into a spring that tasted bad and says, I've purified these waters, and they shall not have death or unfruitfulness in them any longer. This was probably actually a miracle that it was. It probably wasn't the actual sodium chloride that made the spring produce good water again, but it was a symbol, the salt purifying the water. And in Mark 4, there's a curious saying of Jesus where he says, everyone will be salted with fire. And what on earth does that mean? I did a bit of reading on that, trying to figure out what that meant. And the best explanation I found in John Calvin's commentary on this verse. He says that he compares it to Matthew 5, and he says this is a different use of the same idea of salt as a purifying agent, a sterilizing agent. When Christ spoke in Mark of eternal fire, he was urging his people, by contrast, rather to offer themselves now to God as holy sacrifices for the seasoning of fire and salt, instead of letting their sins drag them into the fire which is never extinguished. Inasmuch as salt and fire share the same function of purging and refining, Christ applied the same word to each. Notice that the faithful should not refuse to be put through fire and salt, as without this treatment they can never be made God's saints. He alludes, of course, to the precept of the law in Leviticus 2:13, where God expressly forbids any oblation to be made without salt. He now tells us that the faithful should be salted with the word of the gospel, that they may find sanctification. There is uh, a symbolism in the salt as a purifying, cleansing agent, as fire also does that. A third category of the use of salt that I found in the scriptures had to do with a covenantal relationship with God. Leviticus 2:13 says, "Every grain offering of yours, moreover, you shall season with salt, so that the salt of the covenant of your God shall not be lacking from your grain offering. And with all your offerings you shall offer salt." And thus, salt was also put on the animal offerings as well that were offering to the Lord. Every offering that went up in smoke on the altar had to have salt applied to it. And it's called the salt of the covenant. Numbers 18, the covenant is also mentioned again. To the priests, all the offerings, the holy gifts which the sons of Israel offer to the Lord, I have given to you and your sons and daughters with you, the priests, as a perpetual allotment. It is an everlasting covenant of salt before the Lord to you and your descendants after you. Here is another covenantal language connected with salt. And then a third place that this is mentioned is 2 Chronicles 13. "Do you not know that the Lord God of Israel gave the rule over Israel forever to David and his sons as a covenant of salt?" The salt was used in these sacrifices, which were part of God's covenantal relationship with Israel. And even after the Jews returned from Babylon, they continued to put salt on the sacrifices. King Darius made sure that they had salt in order, along with all the other materials for rebuilding the temple and restarting the sacrificial system, because he knew they needed salt for the sacrifices. It's also mentioned in Artaxerxes' decree in Ezra 7. And also in Ezekiel 43, speaking, I believe, of restarting the sacrifices after the exiles returned. "The priests shall throw salt on their presentations, and they shall offer them up as a burnt offering to the Lord." And it's carried on today in the koshering process of meat. You can buy a koshering salt, in the grocery store. It comes in larger crystals than table salt. And that's related to the Jews observing the command not to eat blood, meat with the blood in it. Salt, there is a natural process of osmosis by which, if you have a high concentration of solute in a liquid, and you have a membrane, and then you have another liquid with a low concentration of solute, then the liquid will pass through the membrane and eat until the concentration of salt on both sides is equalized. And so if you put a lot of salt on the outside of the meat, it draws liquids through the membranes of the cells out of the meat, and thus is a way of drawing blood out of the meat. There's your science lesson for the day. Osmosis. In the Sermon on the Mount, though, how Jesus is using salt in a figurative way. What does it mean, the salt of the covenant? I think the thing that is common to every instance of the use of the word, this phrase, covenant of salt, salt of the covenant, is the concept of perpetuity, something that lasts forever. And each case, now it's not the sacrifices that lasted forever, because of course the Jews quit offering sacrifices after 70 AD, and the Christians quit offering sacrifices before that. But is there something about these animal sacrifices that is everlasting? I think that the covenant behind them is everlasting. The fulfillment of those animal sacrifices and the death of Christ, which was purposed from eternity past, accomplished in 33 or so, 30 A.D., with the death of Jesus and his resurrection, and applied to all of God's children throughout history, and which will continue to be the basis upon which we remain in a saved state throughout eternity future. There is an eternal perspective. The sacrifices were a picture of that. They were a picture of a substitute dying on our behalf to pay the price of sin and reconcile us to God. The big picture behind that smaller picture of the sacrifices is an everlasting picture. It's the everlasting plan of God to save his people, and that's a salvation that will be forever. The covenant with David was that there would never lack a son of his on the throne. Jesus is the eternal fulfillment of that. Jesus was a physical descendant of David through his mother Mary. And so, and Jesus is now, as we said in our creed from Hebrews, he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high. That is a picture of enthronement, where there is a king, Jesus, descendant of David, seated throughout for the rest of eternity. There is an everlasting covenantal promise which will never never go away. It's fulfilled forever. We're reminded over and over again in Psalm 136, it's God's covenant love that endures forever, right? It's God's loving kindness that endures forever. Based on these Old Testament passages, I believe that in this use of the concept of salt in the Bible, it represents generally the eternal saving relationship that God makes with his people. Now I want to go back over these three areas again, three uses for salt in the Bible. First, salt brings good flavor to food. Just looking at the picture of the salt crystals on the pretzel makes my mouth water. In 1999, there was a study done at the University of Tulsa where they took different solutions and fed them and let a series of volunteers taste the solutions. One of them was a bitter, had some bitter urea in it. One of them had sucrose in it, and they had a couple different other things. So they had the volunteers taste these samples, and then they put salt in each of the samples, stirred it up, and then had the volunteers taste the samples again and describe the difference that the salt made. And the conclusion of the study was that salt masked bitter flavors. When they put salt into the bitter and unpleasant tasting things, it made them taste better. It did not make the sweet tasting things taste better, however. The salt had a way of making things taste better because it masked the bad tasting things. It's interesting to consider the created design of our bodies. If salt is necessary for life, what would have happened if we didn't have a salt receptor in our taste buds? Humans wouldn't end up eating enough salt. But God has made us with a special set of taste buds on our tongue that can taste salt. And because we have those taste buds, we can enjoy the taste of salt in moderation, and we can notice if we're not getting enough salt into our bodies. Likewise, the world needs, just like our bodies need salt, the world needs us as Christians to be to bring the goodness of God into it. Without us Christians, there is no normative way for the goodness of God to be brought into the world, except by God's miraculous intervention. Those whom God has decided to save will experience us being the salt of the earth, like salt-sensing taste buds are excited by the taste of salt. Paul put it this way in 2 Corinthians, we are a fragrance of Christ, or maybe a flavor, they're related, of Christ, to God among those who are being saved and among those who are perishing. To the one, an aroma from death to death. To the other, an aroma from life to life. Just as our taste buds recognize we need salt and this tastes good, those whom God is saving experience, they see the life of Christ in us and they say, this is good, I want that. Those whom God is not saving actually hate us for that, and that was what the last beatitude was about. Blessed are you when them persecute you. There are going to be plenty of those who, when we show forth the qualities of Christianity, which are in the Beatitudes and which are characterized as salt here in verse 13, there are going to be people that hate that. They don't have the right taste buds, as it were, for coming into a relationship with God. Not only is salt necessary for life and make food taste better by suppressing unpleasant flavors, it also keeps the bad germs out, the sterilizing agent. In Scripture, we realize that we need some kind of a sterilizing agent, some kind of a preserving agent, because as you see these verses up on the screen, before the flood, all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. After the flood, the intent of man's heart from evil, from his youth, is evil. During the days of David, he said, there's no one who does good, not even one. In the days of Isaiah, you continue in your rebellion, and from the sole of your foot to the tip of your head, there's nothing sound. And in the days of Paul, he said, you are dead in your sins and trespasses. And by nature, children of wrath. The world is dying and is in need of a cleansing, preserving agent. And the remedy for this, says our Lord here, is the active presence of His disciples among their fellows throughout the world. The character and principles of Christians brought into close contact with the world are designed to arrest the festering corruption of humanity and season its insipidity, wrote Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown in their commentary. So salt makes food taste better, it keeps the bad things out, and then third, it's a symbol of a covenant relationship with God, without which there is no salvation. In the second half of verse 13, we have the situation of salt losing its flavor or becoming insipid or unsalty. And the Greek word behind that is morante here. And it's the word that we get the English word moron from. It has to do with being substandard. Not having properties that it ought to have. And so from this, it's translated foolish when it's speaking of a person. And this is the only place where it is related to food. And so it's translated lose its flavor or whatever like that, lose its saltiness. But everywhere else in the Bible, this word is only applied to humans. And being stupid or foolish or substandard in their wisdom and intelligence. Here's just a few uses. I don't want to spend much time on this, but Deuteronomy 32, they've corrupted themselves. Their spot is not the spot of his children. They're a perverse and crooked generation. Is this the way you respond to the Lord, you foolish people and unwise? And Psalm 94, they slay the widow and the stranger. They murder the fatherless. Yet they say, the Lord shall not see, neither shall the God of Jacob regard it. Understand, you stupid and fools, when will you be wise? Isaiah 32 speaks of these fools who speak villainy and his harsh work, iniquity, practice hypocrisy, utter error against the Lord, make empty the soul of the hungry, and cause the drink of the thirsty to fail. In Jeremiah, these people are called morons who have eyes that don't see, they have ears that don't hear. In Matthew, Jesus uses this word, everyone who hears these sayings and doesn't do them will be likened to the fool, the moron, who built his house on the sand. And then he goes on to call the Pharisees morons in Matthew 23. If salt has lost its flavor and has become tasteless or substandard because it has so many impurities, do you want to eat that? I found some salt. I took a walk around the block. So that you can pass it around. I took a walk around the block yesterday and noticed that salt from the road crews had been shoveled off the road and washed off the road and was piled in piles mixed in with dirt along the side of our road. And so I picked some of it up. There's a lot of salt in that dirt. Since there's a lot of salt in there, would you be willing to put that on your food? I hope not. What Jesus applied, there's stories from different people that have lived in Palestine about this salt being trampled underfoot because it's useless. There's one guy that was living in Sidon, a little north of Israel, I guess that's modern-day Lebanon, and he said there's this one merchant that had purchased tons and tons of salt from Cyprus in the middle of the Mediterranean and had it shipped over to Sidon. He was storing it in like 30 different barns on a bare earth floor. He said he saw them as they would shovel the salt out, and once they got into a certain level, pretty close to the floor, they would not try to sell the salt that had been touching the dirt. They would just shovel it out and put it out on the street because it was not good enough to use. There was a fellow, Chuck Genius, who wrote a book called, I think could be translated, The Mountains of the Hebrews. Where he said there were some salts that were mined, they had so much bitumen in them, so many other impurities in them, they weren't mined for eating, they were used for putting on places in the temple to keep people from slipping when it got wet. What Jesus is talking about is something that apparently actually happened. But he was obviously speaking of humans here. He's not talking about just minerals. If a person becomes substandard, they become useless for the job to which they've been called. The job we have as Christians is to be the salt of the earth, right? We're to bring out God's goodness and stop evil throughout the world and introduce covenantal relationships with God. That's our job. And if we become substandard in setting the stage for God's goodness and fighting evil because we tolerate a bunch of impurity in our lives, then God doesn't find us as useful in accomplishing His purpose for advancing His kingdom. Another problem is, if we become substandard in distributing ourselves throughout the entire world, if we're just the salt of our church building rather than the salt of the earth, then it doesn't matter how pure you are, does it? If you're not able to bring that goodness out into the world, you're useless as far as accomplishing His purpose of extending His kingdom. God told us, Jesus told us, to go into all the world and be a witness to all people. So here are some ways that this is speaking figuratively of us as people. We don't want to be people who are substandard in distributing ourselves throughout the earth, or substandard in maintaining the purity of God's goodness in our lives. To be cast out and used for payment was not a positive thing. The word for trampled or trodden underfoot is used about 30 times in the Bible to indicate being conquered, being humiliated, dying a shameful death, being robbed and pillaged and spoiled. Those are ways that this word is used. Here's a few instances of it. In a war, treading down the enemy in Judges 20, Isaiah 10, woe to Assyria, I'll send them against a hypocritical nation, against the people of my wrath, to take the spoil, take the prey, and tread them down like mire in the streets. Isaiah 28, the crown of pride, the drunkards of Ephraim shall be trodden underfoot. Speaking of the conquering that Assyria and later Babylon would do of the Israelites, because of the sin of Israel, they had allowed impurity to a level that they could not be useful for God's purposes. And God had them trodden down by enemies. Amos 4:1, hear this, you cows of Bashan and the mountain of Samaria, who oppress the poor and crush the needy. There's another use of that word. As we look at some of I just wanted to bring quotes from two commentaries about this. One here from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown brings out the point that Jesus is not talking about whether or not we can lose our salvation. Okay, if Jesus is talking about salt becoming moronic or losing its flavor or becoming substandard, I don't think that this is talking about us losing our salvation. The question is not, can or do the saints ever totally lose that grace which makes them a blessing to their fellow men, but what is to be the issue of that Christianity which is found wanting in those elements which can alone stay the corruption and season the tastelessness of an all-pervading carnality? Since living Christianly is the only salt of the earth, if men lose that, what else can supply its place? The offense is not the mere want of a certain character, but the want of it in those whose profession and appearance were fitted to beget an expectation of finding it. It's the clouds without water concept. Is that from Isaiah? People expect something of us if we say we're Christians and if we associate with the church. They expect to find the goodness of God coming through us. They expect us to be combating evil. They expect us to be sharing the gospel. And if we're not doing those things, then that's a big, big problem. Matthew Henry wrote in his commentary, the apostles were the salt of the whole earth, for they must go into all the world to preach the gospel. It was a discouragement to them that they were so few and weak. So what could they do in so large a province as the whole earth? nothing if they were to work by force of arms and dint of swords. But being to work silent as salt, one handful of that salt would diffuse its savor far and wide and go a great way and work insensibly and irresistibly as leaven. The doctrine of the gospel is as salt. It's penetrating, it's quick, it's powerful, reaches to the heart. It cleanses, it's relishing, and preserves from putrefaction. We read that the savor of the knowledge of Christ in 2 Corinthians 2, for all other learning is insipid without that. We as Christians are a sweetening and preserving influence in the world. Now, we saw in the last Beatitudes, the world may hate us for doing that. I was in a meeting in Lawrence where we were talking about problems with cross-dressing a little earlier this week. And half of the people there were in favor of cross-dressing and were got very angry and said some very bitter and hurtful things to us. That's to be expected when we try to present God's standards of what is right, and we try to be a influence of righteousness and goodness in the world. That's to be expected. And sometimes you don't even have to say a word. People still change their behavior based on this, you being in the room. Have you ever been in a situation where you know there's somebody that is very free with profanity, and you walk into the room and then they suddenly start trying to drop out their curse words and apologizing when they slip and do say a curse word? Our presence, our mere presence, can be an influence for good with other people. God alone knows how far more corrupt the world would be without the restraining example in life and prayers of the saints, wrote William Hendrickson. So I want to look at three applications based on these three uses of salt. One of them is a plea. Don't let your salt become impure. Don't let it get mixed in with dirt like that road salt that I've passed around in the bag. I think I have time for this illustration. We watched a movie this Friday night called The Great Escape. It's a war movie about a group of Air Force officer allies that were put into a German prison camp. And at the beginning of the movie, the officers are filing into the prison camp, and the leader of the allied officers meets with the German colonel in the German's office. And the German says, "Look, we have tried to provide a good place for you. It's not going to be a bad, uncomfortable place. All we ask is that you don't try to escape from this place. If you try to escape, your life is going to get hard. You're going to get harsher treatment if you try to escape. It's good for us and it's good for you if you stay put in this camp and you don't try to escape." And the Allied leader said, "Sir, that's impossible. Our men made a promise." I'm trying to remember the wording. "It's the sworn duty of our Allied officers to try to escape and make as much trouble for you as possible. We can't compromise on this point and stay put in the camp. It is our sworn duty to try to escape." And so the whole movie is this tension between these two values. As Christians, it is our sworn duty to be salt and light. We don't have the option of compromising on these points. We must be salt. We must bring out the goodness of God. We must fight evil. We must share about a covenant relationship with God, where outside of which there is no salvation. To compromise on these things is not an option for Christians. And therefore, we need to seek God with a pure heart. We need to maintain a pure heart. As Paul wrote to Timothy in his first letter, the goal of our instruction is love from a pure heart and a good conscience and a sincere faith. These are things, if we can maintain that without diluting faith in God with dependence upon our own human opinions, we can maintain a pure heart. In the second letter he wrote to Timothy, he said, "Flee from youthful lusts and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart." Again, we can't have a pure heart if we are indulging in sin and lust. Instead, if we pursue the goodness and righteousness of God, that is a way of maintaining a pure heart. You are the salt of the earth, and if you're too impure to represent God's righteousness and holiness and His everlasting love, then God will not honor you. And so we must keep fighting sin in our lives. Don't give up, even with the difficult ones that keep coming back and that are frustrating. Don't give up. Keep fighting sin in your life. If you let it go in your life, then it's going to affect outside of your life as well. How do we keep fighting sin? The most potent way is to delight in God's love for us. That's the most potent way to fight sin. Stubborn self-denial, although we do need to be self-controlled. The way to combat the power of sin is to delight in the power of God and His love for us. Secondly, let's bring out the goodness of God. Let's be salty in our world. Let our speech be gracious, seasoned with salt. Are there ways that you can work on your speech so that when you speak with other people, they are encouraged, they are built up? Are there ways that we can talk about the gospel? Are there occasions where we can sing in everyday life? Sing these hymns and songs about our faith that let the world know the goodness of God. Just as the symbolic salt was part of every sacrifice in the temple worship, is a remembrance of God's covenant love for us part of every act of worship we do to God? It shouldn't be forgotten or left out. And then thirdly, we have a problem in our house. It's usually the toddlers find the salt shaker. And what do they do with it? Right? Put it in their mouth, slobber on it, and now all this salt, that never happens at your house, has it? The salt's all clogged up. And so the next meal, you know, you're shaking and it won't come out and it's all the, of course you can, I guess times I've lived in Florida, this was so humid in the air, we had that problem. So we had to put rice grains into the salt to absorb water so that it wouldn't clump up. But that's a problem that salt has. It clumps up when it gets all wet, and it doesn't flow freely. God has made it clear in His Word that He wants His salt distributed over the entire world. Here are some verses that make that clear. In Genesis, He said over and over and over and over again to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. In your seed all the nations of the earth will be blessed. God intended that from Abraham and his descendants, all the families and nations of the earth would be affected with the goodness of God. Exodus 9:16, God brought them, was going to bring them out of Egypt so that his name would be declared in all the earth. The goodness of God and bringing people out of bondage was to be spread over the entire earth. Isaiah 56:7, God says, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the peoples there, which is a plural of the word people, which is an ethnic group. Then later on, Mark 11, Jesus quotes that, uses the word nations. My house should be called a house of prayer for all the nations. Matthew 28, we have the Great Commission passages, right? Go into all the world and make disciples of every nation, baptizing them in the name of the Lord, of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey all that I've commanded you. Mark 16, go into all the world and preach the gospel to the whole creation. Acts 1:8, you shall be my witnesses unto thee and to Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the uttermost parts of the earth. God makes it clear that his message, his goodness, is intended to cover the entire earth. Whenever we recognize the attitude in ourselves, and I encounter this often, that I don't want to share the good news of Jesus with somebody else. I don't want to make a new friend. I don't want to enter into somebody else's problems. Ask God to forgive you for prizing your comfort over his will. Ask him to give you the courage and strength that you need to take his goodness beyond where you've been before. John Calvin has another good quote here. Christ is encouraging his people to preserve that vigor of faith which rubs off on others. You must take care not only to be well savored within, but to give favor to others. But there's a qualification, but even as salt has a biting edge, the use of it must be so restrained that peace is never disturbed. I want to encourage you with these things. Don't let your salt become impure. Bring out the goodness of God and don't clog the distribution channel.